Hello and welcome, everyone. It's so great to be with you again this week. This is Molly Rowan Leach, and I'm your host for Restorative Justice on the Rise, this 12-week track during the Summer of Peace, celebrating our common humanity. The Summer of Peace is celebrating a lot of different tracks this summer, and I encourage you to check out the website at summit.summerofpeace.net if you haven't already gone there, and find out more about upcoming speakers and guests representing various aspects of the world's leading peace builders, including yourself. We're all teachers and we're all leaders, and there's some incredible voices coming from every point on our globe this summer, and we encourage you to join us, whether it be at next week and ongoing with Restorative Justice on the Rise, or to access the archives and look into those, again, at summit.summerofpeace.net. Restorative Justice on the Rise, as many of you know, is a series that is ongoing weekly, and during its regular season is mainly hosted by the Peace Alliance and myself. We look at ways to discuss the extremely growing movement of restorative justice and to connect people, inspire, and help there to be a sense of networking even via the leveraging of virtual technology. So it's just a great pleasure to be with you all here today. And before I introduce our incredible guest, I'd like to say just a few words about how you can get involved in this conversation as well as all of them. Given that this is a webcast as well as a telecouncil, if you have a question, you can submit it through the programs page on the Summit website. You can also press star 2 on your telephone keypad if you'd like to ask a live question today. So we encourage interaction in all of these telecouncil forums, and your part in it is an important part. So I just want to say that I have been deeply moved by this new friendship and connection with filmmaker and just an extraordinary social activist and peace builder in her own right, Leslie Neal. She's our special guest speaker today, and it's an extraordinary honor to have her with us. I'd like to say a few words about her background and talk just a short bit about the film Unlikely Friends that is just coming out, and then we'll go into a deep dialogue with her and cover a lot of the bases that the film represents and, of course, open up to some questions. So Leslie and her films are recognized for their impact on social justice, and her award-winning film, Road to Return, was narrated by Tim Robbins and presented to the United States Congress, which prompted a bill authorizing $6 million for prison aftercare. Juvies was narrated by Mark Wahlberg and toured the world as one of the top 10 Human Rights Watch films of 2005. Juvies also screened at the United Nations, encouraging the first ever conference on juvenile justice. It won many awards and aired on HBO. Her films encourage in-depth examination of these topics with an uncommon sensitivity, and that's so true. Leslie, you've devoted your life to social justice through the channel of media, and in the green room we were just talking about the importance of raising awareness about key issues through this creative channel. So I just want to honor you and welcome you as we go into our discussion about Unlikely Friends and the significance of film and creative avenues that impact international social justice. So welcome, Leslie. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Molly. It's so wonderful to be here and to be having this conversation with you. I'm delighted.
Me as well, and I'm sure that all of us together who are here from wherever you're calling in from around the United States and much beyond, welcome. And Leslie, I'd love to start out today with maybe talking a little bit about what brought you into this aspect of filmmaking and even photography in social justice. Tell us a bit about your path.
Sure. Well, you know, I really stumbled into it. You know, I had gone off, you know, when I was, you know, a young woman and got a film degree and, you know, worked in the commercial side of things. And then I jumped ship and I became an actress. And I did that. And then I just kind of stumbled in to my very first story, Road to Return, and was invited to come into a prison and was very reluctant and, you know, really didn't want to go. And then when I went, I was just blown away. And it was as if, Molly, you know, like a switch had been turned on in my mind and my spirit. Because I had certainly been like everybody else, mostly where you're afraid of the boogeyman. And if people are in prison, they need, you know, they deserve it. And, you know, whatever punishment they get, I'm sure is fair. And when I went in and, you know, to a prison in Louisiana, and sat in a drumming circle with about 50, you know, convicted felons, my life changed because I had never witnessed such authenticity before in my life. And I was, hearing a level of honesty I had never heard before in the, you know, even in the free world. And so that was the impetus to make my very first film on this program that I witnessed in this Louisiana prison. And it was really based on reentry. And, I ended up saying, okay, I'm going to have to do it myself. And I got a mentor, and that's what started my path. And I realized that, you know, I had a choice of what I could do with my life. And at that moment, I thought, you know what? There's a lot of fights to fight in this world. And, you know, just choose one. And I found for myself that my passion lies in criminal justice reform. Because in that afternoon I spent in that prison, I realized instantly how what we're doing and what we're not doing affects all of us. And I was a young mother. Actually, when I went in, I was about 8 months pregnant. And, you know, I was a young mother, and it just became clear to me that if we don't rehabilitate and help people restore themselves to balance, that next victim might be me or my child. So it was probably selfishly motivated, if anything. But I realized, you know, that through the power of film and through storytelling, really just telling powerful stories, they're not my stories, they're other people's stories, I could open hearts. And, you know, I've always gone back to that line that Bob Dylan says in one of his songs, it's worse to know and not do. And when I realized what was going on, I had to act. And so this is my fourth film. Unlikely Friends is my fourth film. I've done other films, but this is my fourth one within the criminal justice, you know, genre, specifically on, you know, looking at reform.
Yeah. The film Unlikely Friends is so powerful. I was just reviewing it for the second time this morning to be with it, and Mike Farrell from MASH, I believe he was Honeycutt, he narrates the film. And it opens in a very particular way. And I just wondered if you might talk a little bit about the key themes of the film, and maybe just for those who haven't yet to see it, who I'm sure will want to see it and hopefully will even maybe consider doing a community screening, which is something that you're doing with this film, community projects and possible partnerships. Tell us a little bit how it opens and some of those themes.
Well, really, you know, the film takes you in from the get-go that, you know, there's a typical way of dealing with crime, and it's lock them up, throw away the key, and being very tough. You know, we've just seen the rise of whether it's mandatory sentencing, you know, three strikes, but over, you know, since rehabilitation really kind of went out the door in the justice system back in the 70s and the 80s, you know, we've just seen an increase of crime, and I had to ask myself when I first got involved, you know, how have I participated? And I knew, you know, right off the bat that I had voted in some of these laws not knowing what I was doing. And so we kind of start off the film by saying, you know, that's been, you know, the typical course of action, tough on crime, but it's not doing anything necessarily for all victims to heal. And then I tell five stories of not only remarkable forgiveness, but friendship. And I chose to only tell stories really where they've forgiven. There's a lot of cases or stories or unions where people have forgiven, but they haven't necessarily become friends. And and the friendships are probably rarer.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to tell those particular stories so that I could draw people in, because there had been other films done on forgiveness. And I really am asking the question in the film, is there room for forgiveness in the criminal justice system? How can we begin to open our hearts and minds to allow for that to happen for those who want to? Not all want to, and that is completely a respectable choice to make. But those who want to meet with their offender or their perpetrator, and then who choose to forgive out of that, or who want to just forgive out of the off the bat and meet with their offender, it is nearly impossible to do in this country. So that's quickly kind of the overview of the story, of the film. You know, I can talk about the particular stories if you want me to give up. You know,
well, before you do that, I'd like, you make a really important point that I think needs to be voiced or fleshed out perhaps a little bit more for those who may not be aware of some of the conditions or particularities even within the law itself that isolate victims that, you know, I'm sure given the constituency that we have gathered mm-hmm. on these councils, there are many people who have experienced, of course, the experience of being in the role of offender or victim and are continuing on that path. But for those who don't have the awareness, what are some of the things that are written into the system that are causing people to feel so isolated?
Well, of course, you know, it's going to vary state by state, but pretty much, you know, across the field is that it's illegal for a victim and offender to come together. Now, pretty much on the offender side. So if an offender cannot reach out to their victim while incarcerated or even on parole or probation, so that's a big stumbling block. Some states will have like a clearinghouse where, you know, that maybe like a victim offender dialogue department where either side can go and say, hey, I'm ready. I think that's pretty few and far between. It is growing. Since I started the film to when I finished the film, I've seen, you know, shifts happening, taking place, especially within the field of restorative justice. And I've heard from many victims that they have to go through the DA to get to their offender, and that is often blocked by DAs, because once a crime happens, that victim really becomes a witness for the state. And if a victim was to reach out or make contact for any reason, that might impede the state's case. So I've heard from victims, you know, that right off the bat, they felt re-victimized. You know, this happened to me. You know, I'm the one injured here. And it's very frustrating for victims to you know, want to make a certain choice and to be stopped. Those are just a couple of the examples that I've seen. I've also seen at a societal level, I've heard from victims, especially the many victims I interviewed for this film, and then the five victim survivors stories that I tell, that societally they feel very, very impeded and very judged. And I found that really interesting that in a Judeo-Christian society, which, you know, bases its tenets on the Abrahamic truths or laws, one of them being forgiveness, that as a society we judge that act. Like, we teach forgiveness, you got to forgive, but we're not if, you know, something horrific happens.
Mm.
And I found that a real contradiction. I do tell stories of survivors from Christian faith, Muslim, and Jewish faith. But we, you know, and hoping the audience gets that kind of contradiction, that, you know, why are we judging somebody who boldly and courageously makes that choice? So I see that as, in a collective consciousness, one of the big obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we are all the system.
Right.
You know, we like to think, oh, it's them, it's them, it's them. It's not them, it's us. So what is ever in the collective consciousness is what we're manifesting. And I had I have a friend of mine, dear friend of mine, who's an ex-warden, a retired warden. And we talk about this a lot, how, you know, we work together some, how, you know, what are the changes that we can, you know, make. And you know, he had a beautiful suggestion. I'm not sure how it's done, but he said, you know, Leslie, we've got to begin teaching compassion within the system.
Excuse me, Leslie. It just, I love that you're bringing the sense of the cultural shift, the consciousness shift, not just cultural, but also humanity, the moment that we're in and where we've come from and where we're going. And it seems like such a critical time in the sense of also that deeper question that you're pointing to of realization that we are not separate, that we are interconnected, that science is now showing that and proving,
right,
you know, right and left.
Right.
And
right,
that we indeed are responsible for one another. And, you know, at the same time, in this particular conversation, that doesn't mean that forgiving is condoning. As Azeem Kamisa so beautifully says, you know, our dear friend who actually was with us last month on this series, you know, he says it's forgiveness is not about condoning, and it's not about forcing people to do anything that they're not ready to do. And that's what I appreciate so much about Unlikely Friends, is that you do choose to follow the stories of these unlikely friends, but you also bring into the conversation perhaps what might be considered the other side of the equation, which is a woman named Harriet, who is the founder of one of the most powerful victim rights associations in the United States. And it's so important as we move through this perhaps tenuous time of our consciousness to be very clear that, you know, just because we are offering the possibility of the conditions which you can step into if you so wish, it doesn't mean that we're excusing what happened. And so there's a real, almost like primal fear, it seems like, that rises up in this piece of what could be called justice and criminal justice, and especially around violent crime. I just wondered if do you have any comments about that part? I mean, what's underlying in our deeper collective consciousness, and why it's so difficult to, you know, why is there a fear reaction in so many of us when, you know, is it embedded in our DNA, I guess?
Yeah, I think you really hit the point, and I think it is fear. I certainly know it is for me in my own life. My own struggle with forgiveness on a much more superficial level, I suppose. You know, what might stop me is that attachment. to fear. What will happen if? And I've heard, if I do, and I've heard from victims who have not yet made this choice, and there is a fear that there will be a letting go of, you know, the one they lost. That there is a betrayal to the one they lost.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of the stories that I tell are murder. Yeah, there is one which is a personal, you know, injury story, you know, between a cop, you know, and a bank robber. But most of the stories, they all lost a child. And, you know, that the fear of that losing that victim or, you know, their loved one forever if they choose to forgive, or they will have some, you know, sense betrayed them, maybe is one of the things that stops them until their pain becomes so great they realize they have to make the choice for themselves. And in any of the victims I've interviewed, have made the choice, have never expressed to me that they feel more distant from their loved one. I think with the, like, if, you know, if I get made it transgression against me and I'm working on my own forgiveness, you know, the sense of betrayal is, you know, is an attachment. You know, I don't, you know, I want to be right. I want to, you know, be superior. And but I think the stages are probably the same. You know, the letting go, the deeply looking within and finding the interconnectedness.
In the film, there's just a lovely mother who is so authentic and courageous in being, you know, a key part of this film. And for some reason, I'm not remembering her name, but she had the young blonde boy who was murdered on the street. And I remember very clearly what she said, that there was a moment when she had an awareness that she couldn't go on like this,
mm-hmm.
and that she, you know, like it or not, needed to forgive for herself. And she also was very clear that, you know, she still felt it was very important that the murderer of her beautiful son serve his prison sentence, you know,
mm-hmm.
but they become just the closest of friends. I mean, you show them in a conversation, I believe, on Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and they're telling each other that they love each other.
Yeah, that was really powerful. I was filming that and, you know, tears rolling down my eyes.
And to me, that's amazing that you were even able to get that kind of window in, you know, knowing how there are certain rules and regulations around communications coming out of prisons. I just think it's beautiful that you were able to show that in the way that you did.
Well, thank you. You know, that's a whole nother obstacle when you're trying to shine light on the criminal justice system. It's trying to get that access, which really helps, you know, for good or for bad, mold pretty much your film, because a lot of things are predicated on whether or not you can get that access. But, you know, I want to go back, if you don't mind, Molly, to the previous point, because it made me think of my interview with Dr. Fred Luskin, who is probably one of the first foremost forgiveness experts in our country. He started the Stanford Forgiveness Project. He teaches forgiveness. And in my interview with him, I was very interested in the brain science, and we don't have any brain imagery yet, MRI, on the effect of forgiveness on the brain. There's stuff coming out on compassion in the brain, but that will be the next step, I hear, that it's about 3 years away, but they're starting to look at it. And he explained to me that when we, after a traumatic act, when we stay in that choice of revenge, hate, anger, which we're all capable, we're all wired to do that, as well as we're wired for love, compassion, serenity, whatever. When we stay in that pain, we are hardwiring the brain. We're creating, you know, paths of neurons. you know, and I know this personally from, you know, I have a lot of back injuries, and my trainers work with me to kind of rewire that neurological pathway to get me out of physical pain. That happens with emotional trauma and physical trauma as well. That when we stay in that pathway, what happens is we are bypassing the chemical responses and limiting over time our ability for creative thinking. And I don't mean just, you know, painting or singing or draw whatever, music. I'm talking about problem solving. That's what he's talking about. So there is, I think they're going to find out that it is, you know, as Dr. Fred Luskin said, it's probably the healthiest choice to make for your own physiological being.
Mm.
And brain imagery, you know, most likely is going to bear that out. So that's what's really interesting for me. You mentioning Harriet Salarno and her rightful choice, and I respect her choice, and she's been able to, whether I agree with her or not, she's been able to channel her anger,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
in a certain way for more tough on crime legislation. And she seems satisfied with that, and I don't believe anybody is in any right to judge that. But according to Dr. Luskin, there are probably physiological consequences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a living question surrounding all of this, of that is very present for people in this film, of making that choice that is actually very selfish. Forgiveness, you know, is for yourself more than anybody else. And it's also seemingly a question that is very intertwined with the neuropathway piece that you just brought up, which is mm-hmm. so powerful, mm-hmm. around, are we going to open or are we going to close?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to live? Or are we really, in some metaphorical way, going to die mm-hmm. with our lives? You know, and there is a very real sense of that in this conversation of, you know, to forgive or to not forgive, to, you know, to open and allow even the most atrocious of acts upon your most beloved to be somehow the fire of a compassion and empathy or even maybe a friendship and love.
Mm.
And that there are human capacities that we've yet to come to, which we're nearing, it seems, in our collective humanity, in the shift that we're experiencing, as we become more aware of who we truly are as individuals as a part of a collective whole.
Right.
And I just am so inspired by this film and the conversation that it, you know, that it arises. It's very primal, and you know, it's hard to imagine what it would be like to be a victim or to be the mother or father of a murdered child. There's just nothing worse that could probably happen to you in your lifetime.
Right.
And
well,
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Leslie. I would like to also take a station break in a moment
mm-hmm.
and share with people what's coming up and how to get more information about the film, and then go into our next half hour together, starting with, I'd like you to choose one of the stories from the film and talk a little bit more deeply about the particulars.
Great. I was just, I look forward to that. I was just going to add that, you know, I don't know that I could forgive something like that.
Right.
I really don't. I have to be honest with myself. I don't know that I could do it. But what I do know, having made the film, is that I know it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I commend, you know, and honor and respect and bow to all of the people I've taught to and included in the film as well, because I believe they're teachers. And
mm-hmm.
they're showing us that it's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. I'm just delighted to be in conversation here with you all, gathered from wherever you're calling in from or webcasting in from today. We're talking with Leslie Neal, the amazing documentarian, most recently of the film that we're discussing today, Unlikely Friends. Unlikely Friends is going to air nationally on Investigation Discovery Channel on October 21st. And I also want to point out a couple events that are upcoming here. In Los Angeles on August 10th, if you're in the LA area, in honor of International Forgiveness Day, Unlikely Friends will screen at 4 p.m. at the AT&T Theater. That's 1139 South Hill Street, L.A., and Leslie will be there, present, and will be conducting a Q&A session. You can also catch Unlikely Friends at the Annenberg Center Theater in Palm Springs for the Creative Change Conference on November 12th at 6 p.m., and maybe most importantly, to find out more about everything that's going on with the film and for more information, too, about the possibility of doing your own community screening, you can visit unlikelyfriendsforgive.com, sign up for the newsletter, and find out about the related events. You can contact Leslie at chancefilms@mac.com to purchase DVDs. And also, I would assume, for more questions about community screenings. Is that correct, Leslie?
Absolutely, yeah.
Great. So let's go in to this second half hour together, and let's start with the story of your choice. One of the, you know, one of the five vignettes that occur in the film. Pick one that you'd like to share more with us about, and let's go more into the details and what occurred and kind of the leading themes there.
Yeah. Thank you for that opportunity. I guess, you know, Steve and Mark always come to mind. It might be because they were, you know, my first friends to make on this journey, and I've been with them the longest. Steve was a Wyoming highway patrolman in his early 20s. And he is a self-professed good old boy. He, you know, says that he was one of those, you know, and I think this is in the film, he says, you're either a cop or you were a dirtball. We're on very opposite ends of the political spectrum. You know, so he's very, very conservative, right-wing, and, you know, he's a tough cowboy cop. And he was pursuing the call that a bank robber was on the loose on a lonely Wyoming highway, and he stopped a car, not thinking it was the bank robber, but thinking, going to ask him, had he seen the car on the road? And it turned out to be Mark Farnham, the bank robber, who turned around and shot him in the eye. And Steve crawls back to the front seat of his cop car, and he's radioing for help, and Mark gets out of his car and walks the 50 feet back to the cop car and pumps four bullets into Steve, ruining this man's life. He lives. Steve lives. But he can't really hold a job much. Certainly the, you know, the law enforcement agencies, you know, kick him off. And Steve spirals into, you know, drug and alcohol dependency, to battle with the pain, can't hold a job. He's married to a cop. His wife is a cop as well. Their relationship's deteriorating. You know, Steve turns to his faith, Christianity, and you know, one of the main tenets is forgiveness. And you know, his wife suggests that he call the chaplain, the prison chaplain. The chaplain says, you know, forgive it, forgive the guy. And Steve, long road, we're saying like maybe, I think this is 5 years after the incident, reaches out with forgiveness to Mark through letters. And they begin writing, and eventually Mark starts calling him for prison. And once Steve went into prison to meet Mark, he realized, oh my gosh, you know, we had more in common, you know, than uncommon. And they have become best friends. And Mark has been imprisoned 31 years now. And Steve is a three-time state legislator. He has appealed to at least two governors that Mark has served his time and should be released. Mark has been in prison the longest for an attempted murder charge than anybody in the state of Wyoming. And when one of the governors that Steve went to, I think it was Governor Freudenthal, appealed to him to say, it's time to let him out. I'm the victim here. And the Governor Freudenthal says to Steve, "Well, Steve, you may have forgiven him, but I haven't." And when Steve told me that story, he added, "Leslie, I'm the victim. I feel re-victimized by not being heard and listened to. I actually attended the last parole hearing. I wasn't able to film it, of course. But Mark wanted me in there as a witness, and it was a very interesting thing to observe in that one of the parole commissioners doubted their friendship, and they've been friends for over 25 years.
Wow.
And, I saw the anger come up in Steve, and that how dare you insult my intelligence that I don't know an honest friendship. And, just like a segue, that's another thing that I try to address a little bit in the film in a very light-handed way, are all these questions. Is this, that people denigrate the friendship between a victim and a perpetrator by thinking, how could you be friends? You're substituting your loved one. You're, pathologizing it. It's a Stockholm syndrome. You're identifying with your perpetrator. Because we don't want to accept, for whatever reason, we talked earlier, maybe it's fear, we don't want to accept that this kind of thing is possible, that there is a power in forgiveness. There is a power there. And as a filmmaker, what I was astonished by was seeing how that power of forgiveness affects the perpetrator and helps the perpetrator begin to establish a foundation once they've been fully accountable for what they did, begin the road to rehabilitation.
Wow. It makes me think of some of the other examples in some very good films, such as The Power of Forgiveness, that also includes some words and wisdom, deep wisdom from Azeem Khamisa, who, if you don't already know who Azeem Khamisa is, he's featured, of course, in Unlikely Friends. He has great wisdom to share, and his son, Tariq, beautiful boy, was murdered senselessly in a gang-related incident, and he tours around the world speaking to the interruption of gang-related violence, of violence in general, and also to how one might even begin the journey of forgiveness. And he's very specific in also saying that forgiveness is not about, like as we were saying earlier, not about condoning the behavior or crime. And so I'd really love to just take a moment, too, to hear your perspective, given that this is restorative justice on the rise. What's your perspective on restorative justice, and what does it mean to you, Leslie, and what do you see moving forward in the ways that might help support victims more deeply? What are the ways that perpetrators might be supported more deeply, and what does it take for us to systemize restorative justice even further? I have my own ideas, of course, about that, but I'd love to hear that from you.
Well, I don't remember all the points in that question, but I'll do my best to...
I tend to ask long questions.
So. But you'll have to bring me back, because I'll be sure I'm in the brain.
And we'll go from there.
Yeah. When I did my first film, Road to Return, the main guy in that film was a bank robber. And he was eventually, his sentence was eventually commuted by the governor of Louisiana, and he, after serving 12 years, and he's telling me a story, you know, that he went back to the bank to apologize once he got out of prison 12 years later. And they're all sitting around the conference table, and they're swapping pictures of each other's, you know, families, and they're talking. And the bank teller, whom he held the gun to, her head, turns to him and with tears rolling down her face says, "Thank you so much for coming back and apologizing, because I haven't been able to get you out of my head for 12 years. And, you know, that I had this huge aha moment. I understood immediately how that meeting was healing them both. And I was so excited. I was telling people, it was my very first film. It was a long time ago. And I was just learning about the criminal justice system. And somebody said, "Well, that's restorative justice, and it's coming out of Canada through New Zealand, and it's based on, you know, tribal societies and blah, blah, blah." And I'm like, and I could never remember the term. I think it's a horrible term, restorative justice. But, you know, it certainly has meaning. And I knew at that point, you know, 15 years ago, that I wanted to do something on it. And it really wasn't in our country much yet at all. So I'm excited that, you know, 15, 16 years later, we're talking about it. You know, we were not talking about restorative justice even when I started making Unlikely Friends, Molly. And now there's groups. We're seeing it in schools. We're using it with juveniles. We're not using it too much with the serious offenders. So I knew I wanted to come back and do something on restorative justice. I won't say that Unlikely Friends really is about restorative justice. There are a lot of wonderful, beautiful films out there already about restorative justice and victim-offender dialogue. I'm very happy, though, that restorative justice groups are embracing it and using it. You know, Howard Zaire, who's considered the father of RJ in our country, pretty much, you know, he said something very complimentary about the film. He said it does not conflate forgiveness and restorative justice.
Right. I love that.
And,
that's a point that really needs to be driven home,
right,
as this movement grows and becomes more systemically oriented.
That's right, because, you know, forgiveness does not need to be part of restorative justice or victim-offender dialogues in order for restorative justice or victim-offender dialogues to work, period. Doesn't need to be in there. But what I wanted to talk about was, what about those victims who do want to make that choice because they've been severely ridiculed for making that choice? We talked earlier about the collective consciousness and cultural, you know, views and the threat that the system has if somebody makes that choice, that they're sick, so we don't want to let them in. And what's their ulterior motive? They want to kill the perpetrator. You know, all this stuff is spun around. Saying, well, maybe there's something to bring victim and offender together. And, you know, the head of the California Corrections Department at the time, Matthew Cate, is interviewed in the film. And, you know, California's the biggest one, Corrections Department. So that's why I wanted to interview him. You know, and he admits, well, maybe it's time for us to look at something new.
Mm.
Not to say that forgiveness, but to talk about restorative justice principles.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think, Leslie, of, another film that isn't so well known, but, well, it may be well known in particular circles, but it's very powerful nonetheless. And I believe it's called something along the lines of Meeting with a Murderer.
Yeah,
It was shown at the Restorative Justice Symposium where Howard Zaire,
mm-hmm.
He was present and selected it as a film for us to all watch.
Mm-hmm.
And you said something about the shift in the victim and in the offender. Mm-hmm. And this film, if you want to see an example of a complete different look and presence for somebody, it illuminates that very fact, the before and after kind of sense of
of, you know, you track the victim and her, well, the victim's mother and her family and their process. And then you also are watching, you know, pre-meeting of the victim and offender, the offender's journey and his, you know, just his facade and what he looks like. It shifts completely after they have that dialogue, and it shows that it's, you know, it's not a forced process, and especially when it's done with someone who is a master facilitator, who might be a representative from a victim offender mediation association, as you were mentioning, or there might even be more than one person present. In the case of Sujata Balaga from the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, she went in and helped to manage and facilitate a process in Florida that actually made, I think, the front page of the New York Times recently about the murder case of Ann Grossmere. And so we are seeing, as you were saying earlier, we are seeing not so many violent cases that go through the process, a restorative process of sorts, but it's certainly possible. And in fact, in New Zealand, there's evidence that it's even more preferred for violent crimes because of what it can do to release the offender and the victim from some of the points that you're bringing to the table that are so important. And again, you know, again and again, that this is a process, restorative justice is. And I just want to say, I love what you brought up around, not really liking that term, because to me, I agree with you on many levels. It's oxymoronic to even call justice restorative, because isn't that what we're trying to do anyway?
It's just not emotional. That people don't hang on to it. That don't know anything about the justice system or the or RJ. People just on the normal. It's a hard, for whatever reason, the verbiage is not doesn't have an emotional attachment to it.
Right.
That's my problem with it. But I've become, you know, the more I'm ensconced in it, the more. I am aligned with the term, but you know, I want to go back to a point you just brought up, and that's how it affects the offender. And I learned this from offenders. I learned this from experts or victims or survivors. I learned it from offenders, and that is that offenders feel immediately victimized themselves when they go into the system, right or wrong. But it's an oppressive system, you know. And they're very quickly, their viewpoint switches to them, how they've been wronged. And they lose contact with what they've done and that victim.
Mm-hmm.
And I just find it so interesting that, you know, our entrenchment in keeping the victim and offender away is like contributing to the whole problem. And one of the things that restorative justice does so beautifully is that by bringing that offender together with that victim helps make them accountable for what they've done, because they see it. And they learn about each other that they're both human beings. And that offender hears the effects that their choice made. On many, many lives. You know, it's just not one. You're just one family. It reverberates out to the community.
Right.
And that insight is often the first step to take accountability, which, of course, is the cornerstone to any rehabilitation whatsoever. And so I think it's tricky. We don't, you know, you don't want to say, like, to all victims, you got to do this. You got to do a restorative justice encounter, a victim-offender dialogue. And especially, you have to forgive, which a lot of victims are afraid of participating in a restorative justice practice because they're afraid they're going to have to forgive.
Right.
And we certainly don't want to put more pressure and responsibility on victims and survivors.
Absolutely not.
We do not want to do that. So it's a tricky thing. But what I'm trying to say in the film and ask the question, for those that want to, shouldn't we make it more accessible?
Mm. And you also make it clear, too, in the film, through just the story of like, say, with Mark and Steve, they write letters first. So mm-hmm. it's not like it's an immediate, okay, we're all going to meet face-to-face. In fact, more often than not, it starts with something very safe that feels safe, for especially for the victims, like perhaps a letter that is, you know, even stewarded by someone they trust. You know, I know that, like you were saying, the idea of an offender writing a letter to their victim, I don't necessarily think that that's something that is even legal at this point, unless there's special conditions.
All right, they do it for parole conditions, but then it's just kind of left there in this, I guess, this no man's land, you know, until that victim might want to read the letter. That's at least how it works in California.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't do it necessarily until they're up before that parole board.
I really appreciate that you bring up community as well, because community is named as an important aspect of a restorative process. And as the field grows and as it is becoming more and more implemented, the community is the body that is in many ways invited to, if they so wish, make more known how the process works, how they can reach out and build relationships with DAs, with judges, with law enforcement officials, with corrections officials even, and to, you know, with that baseline of a relationship of, hey, you know, what's working and maybe what's not working, and how do we see maybe moving forward together in a way that makes a lot more sense, even at the bottom line, as far as dollars. There's growing proof in the recidivism statistics, for example, here in Colorado, where we see a 10% recidivism rate up in Longmont with their programs, as compared to the national 60 to 70%
amazing.
Recidivism.
Amazing.
And it's amazing, isn't it? And,
yeah.
Mike Butler was with us a few weeks ago, and mm-hmm. he spoke to those stats very, very powerfully. And he's a police chief, and he's a right. strong advocate for, putting restorative justice into practice where it can be. And
what's so interesting to me, Molly? Excuse me for interrupting,
no,
but you just
bring it.
It's not rocket science.
right.
It's not rocket science. But based on our anger and attachment to retribution, we are shooting ourselves in the foot and contributing to the mayhem in this society. You know, and that's what restorative justice talks about, is that it's really restoring, you know, the whole community, all individuals, to balance. Because if Azeem makes this point in the film, you take somebody's life, you know, there's something wrong. There's an imbalance there. Now, there are sociopaths that, you know, a small, much smaller percentage out of the, you know, I've talked to federal prosecutors about this, you know, it's such a small percent of the whole overall population, prison population, you know, but you know, they might not ever be able to be restored to bring back to balance. I don't know. But it's a different thing than people who are making choices out of anger fueled by drug and alcohol, fueled
by their own abuses.
Yeah, right. And so as a society, the restorative justice principles is really trying to bring us all back into balance. And why we are so resistant to that amazes me.
And that's why I love so much the great gift you're bringing through what our friend, late friend Tim Hetherington used to call the unlikely channel to bring people together of film, of photography, of media, and to illuminate the stories that we actually share a lot more in common than we realize. And it seems to be that by helping each other to see that there's a bigger picture, for example, in you know, in many offenders' lives, not to excuse their actions, but certainly to understand that they were motivated perhaps by severe abuse of many kinds that are unthinkable, mm-hmm. and that cycle then outpictures itself through their actions. And if we don't address that, and if we don't stand up and look at that and help each other in a respectful way to see those things, then, you know, we run the risk of the samsaric cycle of violence continuing, don't
mm-hmm.
we?
Mm-hmm. I think we do. Well said.
So, Leslie, I want to take a few more minutes before we have to close today to talk about screenings in communities and a little bit more about what's ahead, because I love this idea that you you know, might be offering the film in a certain way for people to bring into their communities. Could you tell us a little bit more about what is happening in that way and anything else you'd like to share moving forward?
Yeah, you know, I'm very, very happy that, you know, Investigation Discovery has picked it up so that, you know, people can watch it nationally. But it's also incredibly important to me that the film be used as a tool. You know, it's just beginning to come out and available, but my work's been used a lot at the community level, and I think this is a very important film for people to get and share with their community. We have a whole tiered system of how people can do that, and it's pretty, you know, nominal fee and that kind of thing. So please contact me for anybody who's listening who might want to do this. Already it's being used in prisons by people who are hearing about it word of mouth. I had one chaplain in Nebraska write me, and he said he's never had such a reaction and positive participation from inmates from seeing any other film he's ever used, which is a huge surprise to me because I didn't really make it that much for the offender. I made it for victims and survivors. But to see that the incarcerated population is really feeling like they're heard, and it's motivating them to have dialogue it's thrilling for me. But also people to use it in their churches, their groups, their synagogues, you know, have a pizza party, invite your friends over, talk about it. I just really want to invite the community, you know, all over to know that it's a tool that they can use.
Mm. And it's such a powerful example, Leslie, for those who might be listening or will be tapping into the global archives of this series to have a sense that this is possible, like you're saying, that this is a possibility. Maybe some people are thinking that they can't. You know, and that's a roadblock for them in their hearts, in their individual lives, that now perhaps is being, you know, shown that there is a way, that this could happen, and that there are examples out there of people. I think of Therese Bartholomew and her journey in South Carolina with the correction system, the first type meeting of its kind ever in that, mm-hmm. that Therese and her brother's murderer met mm-hmm. in a process just recently, and she had a film called The Final Gift that's very mm-hmm. powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But your film, Unlikely Friends, provides so many layers for people that will I hope go off into the world in, you know, as it deserves, in a way that will create great and deep conversations, perhaps even the realizations of possibilities that might not have been there before because of this film. It's been just a great honor to have you with us, Leslie, and I want to talk just again as we close about how you can stay in touch with Leslie and those events that you can look forward to upcoming. So if you'd like to check out the website, if you haven't already, it's unlikelyfriendsforgive.com. That's all one word, unlikelyfriendsforgive.com. You can contact Leslie directly at chancefilms@mac.com. You also might look out for, if you're in the LA area, the event in Los Angeles on August 10th, and that'll be at the AT&T Theater at 4 o'clock Pacific in honor of International Forgiveness Day. And, of course, other events upcoming. And remember that you also have the opportunity to screen the film in your own community. So I just want to say to all people who have been affected by crime and conflict, which I think includes all of us to some degree or another, this series is dedicated to you. And thank you all for being an active part of Restorative Justice on the Rise, and to Lindsay King, Philip Helmick, Brianna Lorenz-Merrill, and the entire staff at the Shift Network for bringing us the Summer of Peace. We'll see you next week, Thursday, for Jason Taché of Youth Courts International. I'm Molly Rowan Leach, and it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much, Leslie.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor. I've enjoyed every minute.